This is tape number 03B35. It was recorded on Tuesday, October 21st, 2003, and is part of the Beeson Institute module number 3. This is presented by Steve Shogren and is entitled The Courage to Lead an Outward-Focused Church. This recording was produced through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. Please do not transcribe into manuscript form or generate other copies without expressed written permission from Asbury Theological Seminary.
Thank you. Good to be with you guys and gals. I'm in a city that's in shock and horror because it didn't make it into the World Series. And frankly, I was hoping for a Boston-Chicago World Series where the underdogs would make it. And now I don't give a rip. You know, New York has been to the series so many times, it just doesn't make any sense anymore for them to make it. And Florida, who cares about Florida, you know? Now I've ostracized the entire room, probably, or came close to it, so my computer's dead. What's going on here? Oh, my. My computer died.
Yes, it did.
Let's see here. It's just turned off and turned back on. There it went. Sleep. That's okay. Okay, now we're back in shape. It's an apple, so it's in good shape. Apples never die. They just kind of go to sleep every once in a while. So I think it took offense at the joking about New York. So, but we're in good shape now. I moved to Cincinnati about 18 years ago. I came there from California thinking that I would start a California church, and didn't realize that Cincinnati people don't like California. That they are against anything that's from the west part of the country, the left coast, and that they are against new ideas. They don't like ideas that are newer than 10 years old. And in fact, the lead story in the USA Today about a week ago on the front cover was all about second-tier cities, they called it. And Cincinnati was the lead city they talked about. And they said that cities like Cincinnati are trying to regain popularity with young professionals, and that they are trying to regain them because they are losing them to tier one cities like Los Angeles and Dallas and Atlanta and Seattle, places like that. And they quoted, in fact, Mark Twain, where he said that at the end of time, he hoped to be in Cincinnati because everything happens 20 years later in Cincinnati. And there's a lot of truth to that still today, where a lot of things happen 20 years later in Cincinnati, because it is a city that is kind of behind times with ideas and with new concepts and so on. I came to Cincinnati not realizing how neurotically conservative it is. People in Cincinnati wear belts and suspenders at the same time as Cincinnati. That's how incredibly conservative it is. It's a place where presidents come to declare war on nations. You know, George W. came there to declare war on Iraq because he knew he'd get a good response there. And of course, he came there and there wasn't any kind of a rebellion or any kind of a revolt or protest, anything like that. He just came and had a cheering ovation and so on, and that's why he came. And that's history now, and just the way it works. So. The upshot is that it's a right-wing, very Catholic city. You can't throw a rosary without hitting a Catholic. And it's a place where this is a difficult place to plant a church. I came and began to share my vision of planting a church and began to tell my story. And I would say, we're going to plant a church. It's kind of fun to go to. And people would say, that sounds like a cult to me. I'd say, well, it's a place where we'll teach the Bible, where it's meaningful, and you'll find, you know, things that you can do practically in your life that are, you know, realistic, and make the Bible true to life for your life, and make it, you know, worth living. And they say, it sounds like a cult to me. And I'd say, well, the worship will sound more like James Taylor than it does the old-time gospel choir. And they say, that definitely sounds like a cult to me. Where are you from, California? And I say, well, yes, I am. But, so I had a difficult time getting my point across to people, and had just a heck of a time getting going in the first several years I was in town there. And I realized after I'd been there for the first two or three years that I was really, without trying to, I was trying to plant a California church in Cincinnati. And I had to get to a place of absolute and sheer frustration before God could speak to me and give me the idea that it isn't about planting a transplant church in your city, but it's about getting a vision for the city you're in. It's about becoming a part and parcel with the city that God has planted you in. And for me, it was about getting a Lands End catalog and buying Lands End clothes and becoming a real Cincinnatian. And getting a pair of belts and suspenders and starched underwear and all that kind of good stuff that Cincinnati people wear. So it became, you know, part of the deal. I had to become a Republican Party, card-carrying member of the Republican Party and all this kind of stuff. And that became part of my motif there. And I began to talk like a Cincinnati person. I began to think like a Cincinnati person. And before I knew it, I began to become viable to the city. And one day when I was driving my school bus, we had a difficult time for the first several years keeping body and soul together, my wife and I, my kids. I worked as a school bus driver making big bucks, pulling down several big ones a year. My wife worked as a administrative assistant at Merrill Lynch. Our kids were downtown selling pencils. We had our dog on David Letterman. We all just kind of did whatever it took to keep it all together. And one day when I was driving my school bus, I was complaining to the Lord and said, God, you know, what's the problem here? I've talked to 2,000 people. We just had our first Sunday morning meeting. It was 1985 at that point, almost 2 years into our church plant. And I have had a total success rate of 37 people showing up out of 2,000 conversations. You know, what's the problem here, God? And God spoke to me clearly through the Holy Spirit. He said, the problem, Steve, is that you're boring. Now, I've been to Bible school. I've been to Christian college. I studied the character of God in various classes in these settings. That God is omniscient, he's omnipresent, he's all-loving, he's kind, he's gracious. But I never read that he's rude. And so, you know, he's in your face. And he's from New York, I don't know, you know, kind of thing. And so I began to, you know, unpack that. I took it home to my wife, and I said, I think that God told me that I'm boring. And she said, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, but I think God's right. And it's one thing to hear from God. It's another thing to have your wife confirm that prophecy. And so I was really getting kind of depressed about the whole thing and began to unpack that and begin to pray about it and say, you know, God, what isn't boring and kind of listless, and you know, what is it that's, you know, exciting and would attract people to our vision and really get us going forward? And God, over the next several weeks, began to direct me back to the Gospels, began to show me that what isn't boring through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are essentially the least, the lost, and the lonely. The least, the lost, and the lonely. You might want to write that down. The people that Jesus hung around with, the people that the Pharisees had nothing to do with. They wanted nothing to do with it. The church system of the day had no concept of what to do with those kind of people because they were had nothing to contribute to the coffers. They were a drag on the system. They were outcasts of the system of the day. They were weirdos. You know, they were just strange people that had just no part in the system of church. And it's still the same today. They're stumbling blocks for the church. And am I stumbling along in the dark? I ran into this little insight that if I were to love the least, the lost, the lonely, that God would bring along regular people. In fact, what he told me was if you love the people that nobody wants now, later on, I'll bring you the people that everybody wants later. If you love the people nobody wants now, later on, I'll give you the people that everybody wants. And so we began to love the least, the lost, the lonely, the single moms that had nowhere to go, that didn't have enough money to pay their grocery bills. Began to love people just getting out of jail and prison. Began to love people that were kind of mentally defective, people that were just kind of, you know, had twitches, and people that had all sorts of, you know, strange psychological problems. And our church was quite a zoo, if you will. And yet, strangely enough, as we began to reach out to the community doing, you know, middle-class outreaches, we call servant evangelism, doing acts of kindness and generosity toward regular people, doing Coke giveaways, giving away bottles of water on corners, the light turns red, we step out into traffic and give them a little card that has our map on the back of the card, a website address, our phone number, our service times on it. People would show up at church and they would say, you know, what kind of church is this? I've always wanted to be a part of a church that does stuff for free for people. And they would come, and so it became a gathering point of all sorts of diverse kinds of people. You look in the parking lot and you see Porsche Carreras next to rusty old station wagons, next to skateboards to people that barely made it to church, you know, next to a pair of shoes with holes in them, you know, kind of thing. And it was just kind of an amazing, you know, conglomeration of people that came from all over the city. You see people sitting next to one another that were in, you know, fine Italian suits, next to people that had tattoos and that were leathered up and had all sorts of body piercings. And it was just kind of an interesting place. And it's still that way today to a large degree after many years of doing this stuff. And yet it was very clear that God was building a church for the unchurched, people that didn't fit anywhere else. A place where people weren't quite as boring as they started out to be when we began to do this thing to begin with. And so if you look at your outline there, let's go ahead and jump into the outline there. God has placed in the heart of every human being the desire to be otherly, to follow the biblical thinking that is better to give than to receive. We all start out our Christian lives from that perspective as a radical wheelers and dealers in the name of Christ, but we unfortunately usually end up flatlining in our patterns of spirituality after a couple of years. And I think that's, you know, absolutely true, is that we end up becoming people that you know, we start out, you know, radicals. We kind of begin as people going to Las Vegas, you know, gambling everything on, you know, one number kind of thing, saying, you know, God, whatever you want, whatever you have for me, I'll go ahead and go for it. I'll become a person who is a radical for you. I'll do whatever you say, wherever you want me to go, whatever you want me to do, whatever you want me to invest. And yet we hang around people, unfortunately, in the body of Christ, and people find the cheapest way to go forward in the Christian life. Isn't that true? They find the cheapest way to get into the kingdom, the cheapest way to get to heaven. And yet, that isn't the way to live the Christian life. I think that we ought to find the most radical people and hang around those people in our Christian lives. We need to encourage those kinds of people forward in our churches. The new believers, the ones that are taking the hard route, the narrow road, and to you know, promote those people and give them a spot in the spotlight, and not let the naysayers and the conservatives take the route. And I'm a believer that, you know, we ought to let, you know, a couple of elders in our elder board be new believers. That we ought not to let just the business people be elders in our churches. But that, you know, they may not be elders in the true biblical sense. They're older, that they're 50 years old and older, but they're young believers and they think new thoughts, they think outside the box. And so in my thinking, a great elder, just to mix up the lot, there ought to be a couple of people in there that are just totally radical people that think great thoughts for God, and they're willing to risk it all. And this is my thought, you don't have to buy it all, but I'm right. So in my first book, Conspiracy of Kindness, Serve in 1993, I call this progression the move from carp to shark. From risk takers to overly conservative people. I think that we go from carp, which is the idea of going into just a overly observant role where there's no teeth at all. We go from shark, where there's too many teeth, and maybe sometimes being overly aggressive, but I think I'd rather be a shark any old day of the week than being a carp. I'd rather be making the mistake of being too aggressive than being not aggressive at all. I think we need to be risk takers. I'm writing a book right now called Ready, Fire, Aim. It'll be out next year. And I think that it's a timely book because we live in an age that I call the stuttering, dyslexic age, where we're saying ready, aim, ready, aim, ready, aim, ready, aim. We're like a stuttering, dyslexic firing squad, where there's perpetual preparation going on in ministry, but we never get to the point of fire. And we're always getting ready for the next big ministry move. We talk, and we talk, and we talk, and we talk, and we just talk it to death. But we never get to the point of actually seeing fire. So why don't we just get to ready, fire, aim, instead of ready, aim, ready, aim, ready, aim. And my personal approach is fire, fire, fire. And yet I think that's too radical of a title to sell. I think people wouldn't buy that one. And so I just kind of tone it down a little bit and say, ready, fire, aim. And as I've been doing some research in this book, I discovered that most of the really radical people that get things done in the church history, the Corrie Ten Booms, the Billy Grahams, the Brother Andrews, I mean, they were already firing people. They had very little encouragement to begin with. And yet they saw big things out there and they went for it. And they became heroes when it was all said and done, but they were called idiots to begin with. They were called rabble-rousers. They were called, you know, crazies to begin with. And yet, in the end, they look pretty smart and pretty intelligent, pretty incredibly genius types to in the end. But you know, to begin with, I think that they look pretty nutty. So we need to become people that think in those kinds of terms. We moved from our old building, which is a building some of you have been to, I think, at other conferences we've done over the years. We moved from there about 3 years ago. It was an old Baptist building. We bought it from a fundamental Baptist church, the kind that hide weapons in the basement and that kind of thing. And I mean, they're really a fundamental Baptist, you know, very, very fundamental. And anyway, Dale's going, oh no, we invited Steve and he's really going off the wall now. You know, he forgot to take his medication, oh no. Better take it now before it's too late. Anyway, we converted it to a building. They had a grand total of 500 people on their last Sunday they were in the building. Now, we managed to convert the building around. We got rid of this and that. We converted this to that. We put a video cafe in place. We were the first church in America to have a video cafe. And North Coast, which has become famous for that, kind of copied the idea from us. And they said, that's a great idea. And they took the idea and they developed it to something really spectacular. It's become really wonderful out of that. And Willow Creek, in fact, has gotten their idea of the video cafe concept from North Coast. And so we actually managed to get about 300 people into a video cafe. So we managed to get 900 people into a building that was designed for 500 without breaking the law too much. We prayed every week that the fire marshal wouldn't come by, of course. But we managed to get about 900 people in there. We actually grew to about 3,500 people in that building over 7 services per weekend. And we had our 2 peak services. We had about 1,800 people between those 2 services. So we packed them in there. Now, when we were doing that, we had a purity about us that was really something to behold, I think, that was really something great about it. We moved ultimately into a $15 million facility down the street 5 minutes away, and I think that it was a great move in a sense. It was a necessary move, I guess. Ultimately, it was kind of push came to shove, because you can't continue to have that many services, you know, indefinitely. I was kind of pushing for 10 services, but the children's workers were getting burned out, and they were quitting by the left and right. They were dropping like flies, and we had to keep replacing them. They're wimps. I can do 10 services. The secret is oxygen between services. Just breathe it. I didn't do any IVs. I just did oxygen, and that renews you, and it does great things to your body. You know, pure oxygen. And so, anyway, that was my secret. Dale was asking me earlier my secret to the multiple services, but oxygen does wonders to the body. And at about the time we moved, somebody gave me a prophecy. Now, I don't know what you believe about personal prophecy, but I happen to think that there's a time and a place for personal prophecy, and I think that sometimes they really do come from the Lord. Do some of you guys believe that to be true? You know, you've all seen The Matrix, you know, prophecy and all that sort of thing, you know? And I think that this person gave me a true personal prophecy that was really from the Lord. And the prophecy went like this: beware of the white Volvo station wagons in your new parking lot. Beware of the new white Volvo station wagons in your new parking lot. And in other words, beware of the new people that are coming along with their affluence that will change the way that you approach ministry. And at first I heard it and I kind of laughed it off, and I thought, right, you know, that'll be the day, because, you know, we'll still have our radical go-for-it attitude and our going, you know, after the least, the lost, the lonely, and so on. But I tell you, as soon as we got in that building, white Volvo station wagons and white Mercedes-Benz station wagons and so on, they began to show up like crazy, because we were all of a sudden very legitimate. We were the church to be going to, the church to be seen at in Cincinnati. And it began to subtly sneak in and to change the way that we were approaching ministry. And all of a sudden, we became dull. It became very easy to become dull and not so, you know, concerned about the unchurched in Cincinnati. Became easy to fall prey to not thinking in terms of making a difference in the community. And I think that it was a very subtle thing that began to happen in our midst. And it was a frightening thing that began to happen. And we've had to fight against it ever since then. And now we have a lot of white Volvo station wagons coming, but we have to pray against it on a regular basis that we don't become overcome by the white Volvo station wagons. That makes any sense to you guys? Why I set out to start an outward-focused church? I wanted to start a church that would make a difference in the community. It would make a difference in the community. People are hungry, folks, to make a radical difference with their lives. They don't want to just make a marginal appearance in life and then die. They want to have the assurance that part of their life is counted for something. That's what we are all about living for as a church body. That's what we're all about, we've been called to as pastors and leaders in the body of Christ. We're to give them something big, something worth living for and dying for. And we're to go to the mountain to get a vision from God that will make a difference in their lives. We're to go away and to seek God to get a big, grandiose vision that's really going to make a difference in their lives. We're to go away and we're to say, God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God. You know, what in the world is this unique vision you called me to be about here in X City, this city you called me to? What's the unique vision you called me into? Now, I happen to think it has to do with serving, has to do with loving our way into the lives of the people of our city. What's the specific way you call us to do that? Is it, and I think it has to do with the poor. That's a non-negotiable. I think that's part of the Great Commission text. I think that it has to do with serving the not-yet-believer community. I don't know exactly how you'll do that exactly. I think God will define that to you. But it has to do with loving our way into the hearts of the city. And the specific ways that God will lay it in your heart, I think that's yet to be defined. There's many, many creative ways to do that. But specifically, you know, that's the creative thing that God can fill in the blanks on. But somehow, you know, you've been called to actively love your way into the heart of the city and make a difference. And that's a vision that's worth joining up for, folks. It's not just about going to church and doing church one more week and being a part of just a boring old vision of growing your little boring little thing over here on the corner of so-and-so and so-and-so, you know, on a street corner. That's not worth living and dying for, certainly. It's worth going to get a good message, perhaps, every once in a while, but that's not worth really going for at a deep level. I wanted to build disciples that would be deep. If you want to make outreach your number one aim in life as a church, you will go deep. You will guaranteed go deep if you make outreach your number one aim. If you go out to make it your priority to go deep, you'll get just plain weird. I've seen it happen over and over again. We're going to go deep. You're going to get weird is what you're going to get. You're going to get strange. You're going to drown in a sea of deepness. You call it depth yourselves, but it's really not depth at all. It's just strangeness. You get off in some kind of strange teaching. You're going to get off in some kind of a weird doctrine. You're going to make a maypole out of some kind of a weird little issue that's not worth making an issue out of. And you're going to get into some kind of a weird little, tangential issue that doesn't make a bit of difference in the world. And I can guarantee you that it will... make a hell of beans difference in the end. What God's, all over is, going into making your number one issue the outreach. And Willow Creek will tell you this probably in the next 24 hours, is they make outreach their number one issue. They make it far above all their other issues in life. They give 40% of their effort to outreach, and therefore everything else falls in line. I agree wholeheartedly with that issue. I don't agree with everything Willow Creek does necessarily, but I agree with that issue, absolutely full-fledged. I think that if you don't make outreach your number one issue, then nothing else will fall in line. And it takes far more than just making it one of the top 10 things and one of the top 3 things. It has to be the number one thing. And Scripture certainly sets it up that way. With the Great Commission text, with the ongoing emphasis that Paul puts upon it in Romans, with the emphasis that Jesus puts upon it in the Gospels over and over again, that he loves the world so much that he came to die for it and he came to live it, give his life for it, that the kingdom has to go forward. I'm a nut for N.T. Wright. Anybody else an N.T. Wright fan other than me here in this room? I love his way of emphasizing the forward advance of the kingdom. He's worth reading just for that simple idea of he's a kingdom theologian. And he's talking constantly about advancing the kingdom, advancing the kingdom, advancing the kingdom. And that's what it's really all about. We lose track of that so quickly. We get stuck in church business. We get stuck in church politics. We get stuck in thinking about this little issue and that little issue. But Wright has a way of coming back to the simplicity of it. It's all about, taking the kingdom and pushing it forward constantly, making that our issue all the time. Not the issue of church being done, a new... A little twist to it here and there, but making it simple, making it extremely simple. I wrote a book here about a year ago called The Perfectly Imperfect Church, and it's 13 little ways to grow your church to 500 people, which I think is the ideal size church today. I'm no longer a gigantic believer in the super gigantic church. I think that there'll be occasionally gigantic churches out there, but I think they're called divinely by God. And I think there'll be what I call launching pad churches that are out there that are fantastic, wonderful churches. But I think that many churches in the future will be churches of around 500 people. And I kind of lay out my plan of how I think that'll happen. I think the number one thing that'll help your church become like that is just utter simplicity. You know, understanding that we're about one or two or three things in, as a whole. We're not about 50 things. We're just about a few things doing them extremely well. And I think that one of the real tragedies of small churches is they're incredibly, incredibly complicated. As I travel around the country and talk and consult and just try to encourage pastors, I find that the smaller they are, the more complicated they become. And one of the things you got to learn how to say very well if you're going to grow is no. We're not going to do that. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to say yes to just two or three or four things, and we're going to do those extremely well. And we're going to grow past all that stuff of saying things that are probably important to somebody, but they're not important to us right now. The next thing is I wanted a church that would be fun. I wanted a church that would be fun. How's that for an idea? I wanted a church that would be fun. People don't know that you're how to have fun in the context of church these days. And we're not talking about cracking a joke every 3 minutes and becoming like David Letterman necessarily, although I think that'd be kind of cool if somebody could actually become David Letterman in the pulpit. You know, that'd be quite a gift to the church. But David Letterman probably has his off times. He probably isn't very funny when he's off camera. He's probably just a regular guy, kind of depressed and, you know, on Prozac or something like that, I imagine, you know. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is fun. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, right? Almost chapter 7. I think that if I was to go on staff at a church anywhere in the United States today as the assistant pastor or as a senior pastor, one of the first things I would do is I'd go around and I'd make a deal with all the other pastors that are speaking on the stage. I'd say, around here, we're going to make fun of each other, because that'll create an atmosphere around here of lightness that will color everything we do around here in public. We're not going to be a heavy-duty church. We're not going to be around here, you know, making it heavy-duty and all the time, you know, talking about the deep things of the kingdom, the deep things, Richard Nixon, the deep things. I am not a crook. We're gonna talk about things that are kind of fun and up and light and kind of relating to each other and having a good time. You know, at our church we use videos to do that a lot. We don't do dramas. I think dramas are fine if you can pull them off. I find dramas very difficult to pull off. I very often go to churches where they do dramas and they do them very poorly. And I have a hard time keeping a straight face when they're doing their drama poorly. And maybe you do a drama greatly, that's great. You know, God bless you and more power to you. But I just find a hard time, you know, even the churches that are famous for doing dramas. I watch their dramas and I sit there going, oh my gosh, these guys are not actors. I mean, they're just like, I don't know what they are, but they're not actors. And they're up there like, it's like 1930 silent movies, you know. It's this kind of stuff, you know. And people are down there supposedly crying and really getting into it. And oh my word, every time I see that, I just think to myself, that's why we don't do drama at our church. We do videos. And videos are so much easier to pull off. You know exactly what you're getting each service. You have it all timed out exactly to the second, how long it's going to be. You can control and you can shoot multiple times over so you know exactly what you're getting. And again, you know, if you're doing dramas, great, keep on doing them. That's great. I'm not trying to knock your drama, but your melodrama, whatever it is. You might consider doing a video instead. My clock just went off over here, so I don't know how much time I've got. Maybe Warren can start the clock again or something. So,
Warren, clean
your clock. Warren, clean my clock if you would. 20 minutes. Okay. But anyway, what I have come up with is that I think you need to rethink the whole thing of drama, but fun has got to be an element in the church. And there's got to be some kind of an element of really connecting with the people. And people that don't go to church have got to find a way of really connecting with the fun element. There's got to be some kind of an entertainment element, I think, in church. Some people have done that extremely well, like Ed Young Jr. has done it incredibly well. If you want to find a guy who's making the fun factor really extremely well done, you know, check out Ed Young Jr.'s website or go down to one of his conferences in Dallas and check out his entertainment, he calls it, I-N-N-E-R-tainment, and see what he does, and you get ideas galore out of that. But the upshot of it is that there's a lot to be learned from that kind of thing. Hindrances to outward-focused church. Take this test. Is your church an outward-focused one or an inward one? Many churches assume that they are outward-focused when, in fact, they are not. Let's just kind of slowly go through this. Let me just make a couple of comments. And you yourself just, you know, make it a yes or a no, but be honest about it. And let's see, you know, where you stand. We have a 2-year plan for evangelism. I find that very few churches have a 2-year plan for evangelism. They don't have a plan at all for evangelism. They're just kind of, you know, barely limping along in their evangelism departments. They don't really have a clear thought in terms of evangelism outreach. They're just kind of limping along. They don't really have a any kind of a thought through cognitive idea going on there. But I think you need to have a 2-year plan going on. We're going to do this and we're going to do that. And then a year and a half from now, we're going to be at this point in the program and so on. But do you have a 2-year plan, yes or no? Second thing is our budget spends at least 10% on local evangelism. I know a lot of us spend massive amounts on foreign missions, but do we spend much on local missions? I think you need to be spending 10% on local missions, local evangelism, if you're going to make an impact on your city. Yes or no is that question. Our lead pastor personally gets out 2 to 3 times per month to do either evangelism or ministry to the needy. Now, if we weren't in a room like this, there'd be an outburst of laughter going on. Because most pastors are total introverts. They like the idea of sitting at home studying and reading their commentaries and spending 30 hours per week getting ready to speak on their Sunday morning message. The idea of going out 2 to 3 times per month is just, you know, totally off the boundaries for them. They wouldn't do that if their life depended on it. So it's just, you know, not even an option for them. So maybe I'm talking to the guys that are doing that kind of stuff. So you guys are senior pastors, I guess. So 2 or 3 times per month doing either evangelism of some sort, servant evangelism, or outreach, or ministry to the needy, or something like that. Getting out. And the great thing about doing it 2 or 3 times per month is that, in fact, you get to talk about it. You get some great stories out of the whole thing. You get to talk about it to your people. There's always a great story or two that comes out of one outing at that. And let me tell you, you talk about those stories to your people, and they will, in fact, say, you mean he went out and did it himself? He actually got dirty feeding the poor? That's amazing. You know, our pastor, they're going to sit up in their seats, and they're going to go, man, what a guy. He's a real producer. You know, he's an amazing guy. So, you know, that'll, you know, come back in spades to really count. We are seeing the equivalent of 10% of our membership baptized each year. If you have 600 people in your church, that means 60 people are getting baptized each year. That's what I mean by that is active membership, in your church. Our pastors and staff have a list of not yet Christian people they are praying for. You make that a normal part of the staff meeting. You guys praying for the not yet converted people in your circle of friends, your neighbors, your relatives. Our pastors regularly call our people to obedience in the areas of evangelism. Those who are speaking, in other words, they make it a regular thing. Let's all go out there and begin to do this stuff. Make it a part of the end of the service. Let's go out and let's go rake leaves together at the end of the service. There's a bunch of rakes by the door. Let's go out and do that as an outreach project. And let's come back and do a potluck afterwards or something like that. Make it part of the deal. Or maybe this week, let's all go out and comp somebody a meal at Taco Bell. As you drive through Taco Bell, let's go ahead and pay for the person behind us and give them a little card from the church that says, this is to show you Christ's love in a practical way. Make it a normal part of your day of kindness. You don't have to do it as something as a program. Make this part of your daily routine. And if the meal's too expensive, pay for the person two behind you. It'll work. Our pastors spend time at least once a year training our people in the area of evangelism. That's pretty simple to measure. We actively inspire our staff, no matter what their area of expertise, to be incorporating intentional evangelism into their ministry area. Even if they're working with children, they still get trained and encouraged in the area of evangelism, because there are people to win to the Lord in those areas. We require all the leadership of our church, from elders, deacons, to small group leaders, to go out to share their faith in an outreach of some sort or a ministry to the poor project. We encourage everybody. There's nobody that gets out of the thing. This is part of the culture of the church. We build it into the culture. So it's not just something that the total extroverts do, but it's something everybody does. We find ways for the average person to do this stuff. I like to say, if you're a total extrovert, you can wash wheels while we do the car wash. You're an introvert, you do the wheels. You're an introvert, you can pack bags when we go out to give away food to the poor. You're an introvert, you can find something to do that an introvert can do. You're an introvert, you know, we got to give away Cokes. You can just pull the Cokes out of the coolers, and we'll dab them off with towels and put cards on them. You don't have to talk to people. Let's do it that way. So do something along those lines. The fruit of an outward-focused church. There is massive fruit that encourages any mindful leader to seek after the outward version of the church. People are hungry for community. Folks, community is spontaneously developed as you build an outward-focused church. There's a common goal in mind that will bind you together. There's a lot of books out right now on community. A lot of people talking about, we got to build community, we got to build this and that. And I see a lot of programs going on. I see a lot of people trying to find the way into the secret to community. I think the secret to community is doing something shared together. You know, living life together is what Bill Hybels says. I think it's a pretty good definition of community. But I think one of the best ways to live life together is by doing something together, by having a common goal in mind. I find that one of the most profound ways to build community is going out and doing an outreach project together, going out there and loving people into relationship with Christ. I find it more bonding to go out and to give away 500 Cokes with a couple of friends, or three friends that I just met, or five friends I just met, than doing a project like that than I find in 6 months of being in a small group, honestly. It's amazing what happens. I don't know what the dynamic is exactly, but I find that it is, you know, entirely possible for me to get to know people at a deep and profound level by just doing a shared project like that, by going out and giving away soft drinks together and loving people into relationship with Christ. There's something of the Spirit that goes on. There's a melding, there's a weaving together of the Spirit. And I can't explain it, except I've experienced it over and over and over again. I'm going to tell a story in a minute or two about how that worked here just recently in my life. People are hungry to make a difference in the world. Everybody wants to make a difference, including the youth of your church. And youth are often the people who make a way. They're the ones who are most radically outward. And my son is a prime example. He's 13 years old, and he's probably the most gifted servant evangelist in the church. He is a radical toilet cleaner. Toilet cleaning runs in our family. We love to go out and clean toilets to show Christ's love in a practical way. We walk up to the manager of a gas station and say, "We just like to clean your toilet to show you Christ's love in a practical way." And people just look at us like we're crazy. And not just my family, but our whole church is in love with toilet cleaning. And we just blow people away with kindness and with the radical offer of generosity. And people look at us funny. "Did you just get out of jail or something? Did you do something heinous in a previous lifetime? You're trying to work out bad karma?" No, we're just trying to show you Christ's love in a practical way. We think that if Jesus were here, that he'd be doing something kind like this to show his love to you. And then they walk over and they watch me clean the toilet to see if I'm going to steal the toilet paper. My son and I are going to Poland here in a couple of months to clean toilets in Poland. And I say, "Just clean toilets." They say, "Well, we want you to come and show us how to clean toilets." And I go, "Well, okay, if you want me to, but it's not that complicated. You just go counterclockwise. That's the key thing." Of course, it does work clockwise as well, but counterclockwise is the way I do it, you know. And bent over is the best position in which to share the gospel of Christ. But, you know, that's really the best way to do it. People will give money in large amounts to the causes of the church when you begin to do these things. They will get involved, and they will get involved at a deep level in the way that really where the money, the pocketbook meets the road. People will follow hard after the Lord. They will begin to pursue the Lord in great depth and great pursuits. They will do like David. They'll follow hard after the Lord. People will seek the disciplines of the Holy Spirit because they will seek to grow spiritually. I think that they will pray more, they will fast more, they'll become people who are truly disciples of all. They will do all the things we're seeking to get them to do if we just get them focused outwardly. This is the sort of church that God had in his heart when he conceived the church. It is a go and do arrangement, not a come and see one. He's talking about a go and do church, not a come and see church. Talking about a church that is aimed out into the community, not a church that is aimed inwardly. And I think that we've had enough of the come and see church. I think it's time for the go and church and do church to escape and get outside the four walls. To get outside the four walls and to aim into the city and to take the city by storm. We're talking about a church that loves its way into the heart of the city and that loves its way into the very center of the lostness of people who don't yet know Jesus Christ in a personal way. Matthew 28 is the basis for our calling. "Go then to all peoples everywhere and make them my disciples." Go then to all peoples everywhere and make them my disciples. That's the very heart of our calling. I became aware of this calling again here just a few weeks ago. I was out with some friends, and we were out cleaning toilets, my favorite project. And I love cleaning toilets because I love the shocked look on people's faces when you walk in and you say, "I love to clean your toilet just to show you Christ's love." And I don't bother to explain my project. I don't walk in and say, "Hi, I'm Steve, and I'm from the Vineyard, and we're here to clean toilets to do a project, a community service project." I don't do any of that stuff. I just say, "Hi, we're here to clean your toilet for free." And their head bobs back a little bit, and they get a head tilt, almost a little bit of vertebrae action going back like this, like they need a headrest, you know, behind their head, whiplash almost action. And so I walk into this nail place, and this lady named Mary is there, and she's Asian. I don't know why it's so, but in Cincinnati, a lot of nail places are run by Asian families for some reason. And This Asian lady and her family was running this nail place, and it was a pretty cool operation, a really nice place. And she said, well, I guess you can wash our toilets. And she says, what's the catch? And I said, the catch is that God just incredibly loves you. And she said, then why are you doing this? And I said, just to show you his love in a practical way. And she said, well, you know, it's funny. My husband used to clean our toilets, but he died recently. And all of a sudden, she started to break down and get tears in her eyes. And she said, he died about 2 months ago. And the toilets have been the same since. And it was almost, you know, kind of funny, strange the way she said it, you know. And I said, well, we'll do a great job for you, and we'll get it back to the way it looked before. And went back there and did a great job on the toilets. We scrubbed real hard and got looking spick and span. The difference between a good job and a bad job of toilet cleaning is if you get the sides of the toilet. You have to get on your hands and knees and get the sides of the toilet. This is a little toilet cleaning note, you know, for you. So we always get the sides, get down on our hands and knees and get the sides of it, really get all the dust and everything off of it and everything like that. And we have a contest, by the way, on my website at kindness.com right now of the best toilet cleaning stories going on. We're going to give out a couple of meals out. So if you want to send us your best toilet cleaning story, you might win a meal out on us, you know. So go to the website and you can check it out, and if you want to. But anyway, we cleaned the toilet and we got done and we refilled the hand towel dispenser, and she said, you used to refill that too, and I didn't know how to do it. I'm not very mechanically oriented. And so we said, we'll do that too. And we got done, and we said, well, Mary, is there anything we could pray for you about? And she said, well, would you pray that my loneliness would go away? And then she really started crying. I have this tier system I've developed over the years. It goes from 1 to 10. A 1 tier is a male tier that goes up to the eye, and males can, like, suck it back in. They just kind of go like this, and it goes back in. Women can't do that. It goes over the eye and spills down always, you know. But like a level 5 tier goes down to the jaw and it evaporates. A level 7 tier, the nose starts to happen along with the eyes. And she goes into level 7 tiers just like that, you know, and it's just dripping down and all this stuff, you know, and she's over there, and we start pulling off the hand towels, you know, and she's just wiping it off and everything. And a level 10 tier, by the way, is when it just jumps off the face like this, you know. And I've seen that a few times, actually. And so she's into level 7 tiers. It's dripping down. And she says, you know, my husband died, and I'm feeling very lonely, and I'm a Catholic, and I just go to the church every day, and I light a candle for him to get a purgatory faster, and I'm paying, you know, for him to get a purgatory faster, and buying condolences, indulgences, thank you. Condolences, that's different, isn't it? I'm not a very good Catholic, am I? Indulgences, I just am really praying for him to get out faster, and would you pray that he would get out faster? And we said, well, we don't really, you know, follow that thinking very well, but we'll pray for you. And so we prayed, and she just broke down crying even more. This is with a shop full of people in there, and she's just sobbing. And I said, Lord, just let her pain be gone quickly. Would you let her just be relieved of her pain? And the sobbing lasted for about 45 seconds maybe, and then it just stopped. And I think the Holy Spirit did something in her heart and just kind of lifted it off of her. And it was a beautiful thing. It was a really cool thing. This lady who goes to church occasionally, I guess, and doesn't really know the Lord in a personal way. And I was with a couple of college kids from Campus Crusade, and they were just both, you know, walking 6 inches off the ground. We got through with that whole thing. They said, man, we're doing toilets from now on. That's it. You know, we're just soul in toilets. And walked out of there, and we said, we'll come back in a couple of weeks and clean your toilet again, Mary. And we were just back a couple of days ago, actually, and she's doing great, cleaned her toilet again, and she's doing really well. But, you know, a lot of incredible things can happen when you just show just the smallest act of kindness, a small little edge, just taking a few minutes of investment. I like to call it a small thing done with great love can change the world. A small thing done with great love can change the world. That's all it takes. Mother Teresa used to say that. She was just beatified here just in the last couple of days. She's now a saint officially in the Catholic Church. And God bless the Catholic Church. They need more saints now than they ever needed them. They need heroes like never before. And I think that that's really what it's all about, is doing a small thing with great love. I encourage all you guys, you know, be thinking outward. I encourage you guys, you know, the outward-focused church is the only kind of church that's worth building. It's the only kind of church that's really worth joining. It's the only kind of church that people are looking for. It's the kind of church that God will bless. It's the kind of church that is exciting. It's the kind of church that is going to really go places in the 21st century. And I wouldn't want to be a part of any kind of church but that kind of a church. And those are the kind of churches that I'm planting. I'm planting right now 15 churches at a time that I'm coaching. And they're all incredibly exciting. And so I bless you. You go plant an outward-focused church and do it with great speed, and the grace of God be upon you. So God bless.